Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Can I ask you a question? Imagine spending 9 years of your life training to be something, being so close to the end, and then realizing this isn't for me. What would you do? Well, that is what happened to my next guest when he joined the priesthood. He's on the line now to share his story. Joe Armstrong, good morning.
Good morning, Jen. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on.
It's great to have you. How was your weekend?
My weekend was absolutely gorgeous. I had a wedding, an outdoor wedding. I've only had two weddings because of COVID all year. And it was an outdoor wedding in Belinter House, a gorgeous venue. The
Lovely.
Sun was just gorgeous. There was an intimate gathering of people. Of course, a couple wanted loads of guests, but a COVID reality couldn't happen. And it was a beautiful, beautiful wedding. Absolutely gorgeous.
Sounds gorgeous. Sounds gorgeous.
Yeah.
Joe, can you take me back to teenage Joe? You grew up in a religious household, is that right?
I did. My mother was very religious. My family was religious. But then, honestly, most of Ireland, at least from the perspective of me, aged, you know, from 15 up or indeed from 5 up, the whole world seemed very religious. I was Catholic and, you know, everything seemed to be true about religion. And so, you know, the Pope arrived in Ireland and a million people. At the time, there were only 3 million people in the Republic. A million of them were in one field in the Phoenix Park to see the Pope. And the plane goes overhead. And as an 18-year-old or 17-year-old at the time, I remember, you know, the hairs on the back of my head standing up. I was so excited. The first ever visit of a Pope to Ireland. And, you know, as I say in the book, you know, the Brits had the Queen. We had the Pope.
Oh,
it was that sense of identity, you know?
Yeah. So it that visit sounds like it had a profound effect on you.
Well, it did. It was important, but it certainly wasn't the most significant thing, far from it. I mean, the most significant thing, I remember as a kid, like I was probably about 5, and I was in the living room at home in Dunnycarney. I grew up in Belton Park Avenue in Dunnycarney. Great community, great neighbours and all that. And there was, you know, the way you're just caught up in a dream world when you're a kid. And there I was, thinking I was on my own in the room saying Mass. So I was imitating all the gestures of the priest saying Mass, you know. And then I became aware that my mother and my father were both in the room looking at me. And I was mortified. And it was like as if they just, you know, kind of peeped into my soul and saw what I wanted to do. Like, how does a 5-year-old kid get that idea? Because everybody I knew at the time went to Mass. The priest was a very important person,
yeah,
a powerful person, a respected person, a wise person. And it seemed to make absolute sense to me, you know, to want to be a priest. And also, like, listen to your earlier question about happiness. I just thought, I wasn't interested in money. I wasn't interested in success. I wasn't interested in that. And I thought, well, what's the meaning of life? And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, if God exists, it was always on that if God exists, then it's got to be the most important thing in the whole world. And why would you be going playing golf or watching The Night of Duty? Not that that was around in those days. You know, if God was real, like, it had to be the most important thing. So I was all excited about it. And then there was the charismatic renewal. And that was a thing, it was full of enthusiasm.
So this was a movement, was it? It was a movement you joined. How old were you when that happened?
I'm guessing I was 16, 17.
Right,
that kind of, but a year or two before I joined. So this was sort of building on the family and the faith of the locality and Ireland at the time.
Like, so your mom must have been delighted that that's the way you were going, was she?
Well, funny enough, I was never sure. I was never really sure where my mother stood in it. And I know my dad, when he watched me as a kid doing the imitating the gestures of priests, I heard him saying we might have a priest in the family. And as I say, I was mortified. But I never really knew about my mother. And later, like a year just before I took my first profession, literally the day before I took my first profession, my father, I buried my father the day before I took my first profession, which was a year after I had joined. And, you know, after that, I kind of got a bit of a vibe from my mother that she would like me to come home and to look after her. So I really, like, I know a lot of guys might have gone in because they had the vocation from their mother. That wasn't me. I never identified with that.
Did you have the calling that I've heard other people talk about? Or was that it when you were five? Or
The calling. Okay, firstly, I don't believe anybody who says they got this calling. I just don't believe it, right? So basically, you hear this stuff, and you're like, there's stuff in Scripture, you know, come follow me, and, you know, Peter leaving his fishing leaving his wife and dropping it all and following Jesus. So you're always wondering, and the gorgeous piece in Scripture, you know, Samuel being called, and is that you calling me? No, blah, blah, blah. So you hear all these stories from Scripture about the call, and I would suggest everybody, they kind of wonder, I wonder, am I being called? And, you know, so basically, for me, from the very first moment of faith, literally simultaneous with that, mm-hmm. I have a moment of doubt. And I'm doubting it. And constantly you're asked, well, am I being called? Am I not being called? Is God real? Is he not real? You never know. So you're always sort of, I was always, like, by the way, some people don't seem to have this. Some people just seem to have utter and total and blind faith. Mm. I never, ever envied those people. I always treasured the fact that I was always questioning.
Asking questions.
Yeah. Always questioning. And even after my final profession, like I was in about 7 years when I took my final profession, which is when I committed myself to the congregation, which Mara's father, a great congregation, by the way, and I have great affection for them, right? But, you know, I'd made that commitment. I was going to be with them for life, and they committed to me for life. But like a month after that, I was doubting it again, you know. So, but I always cherished that. And I suppose what I would be saying to your listeners is to always trust yourself. And at the end of the day, I had to make a decision. Like, am I going to believe this interpretation of my life, which says I'm called by God? Or am I going to believe the nudges and the doubts and the ideas and the questions that are within me, what I call in my book my inner workings. And I thought, it's scary to trust my inner workings, because if I trust my inner workings, it seems to be at variance with the authority of the church and the tradition of 2,000 years and what the priests who are in charge of me are saying is true. It's
so
scary.
Basically, listen to your gut. But you joined the seminary, and I mean, as a young priest in the priesthood, you know, asking questions all the time, having that doubt. How did that go down?
The Marists, I did, and I still do respect the Marists, because they were, to my mind, they were open. Now, they weren't open to everything, of course, but they were open to questioning. And okay. I did my theology in Milltown Park. And, like, at that time, like, John Paul II was the Pope, and he had silenced some world-leading theologians like Hans Küng and others, you know? Mm. And there was a fear in Milltown Park. I could pick up the fear in the Milltown Institute that our lecturers were kind of afraid that they might be reported simply for asking valid questions. I kind of picked that up, but I respected them. And I was really sad, actually, when the Milton Institute closed, because I thought it was a really good place where they were kind of authentic in the questions that they asked about God.
Mm. And you attempted to leave, didn't you? Or you did leave. What happened then when that doubt and that gut was screaming at you?
Well, you see, this is it. Like, this is a lifelong pattern, Jen, in my life, where, like, you're attracted to safety. Do you know, like,
everybody
I was five
is,
years.
Though.
Yeah, I know. And but sometimes the safety, and you can kind of get embedded in that. But you know, those inner workings I'm talking about, the trust and the questionings inside yourself, can be at variance with that, and they kind of threaten it. So you have this inner battle between safety and risk, you know? And so I had taken my, I've been 5 years in, right? 5 years in, and and I sort of finally respected fully all of these inner workings, and I cried my eyes out. 5 years in, it was coming up to Christmas, and I just knew that I had to leave. And it was the scariest thing. You know, the Killers have that marvelous line in the song Human about fearing an open door. You know, when I see an open door, I'm afraid. And it was that kind of sense of, oh my God, like my identity, my financial security, my meaning in the world, everything is tied up with being a priest. It's the only thing I ever, ever, ever wanted to be. And here I am. And, you know, and people are telling me, yeah, you do have a vocation. We believe you have a vocation. We think you should stay and so on. And then you have this inner voice, not an inner voice like somebody talking to you, but just your doubts, your normal, natural doubts and questions. And you think, and then you finally reach that point of, I have to respect my inner workings. I have to leave. Loneliest decision of my life.
I can imagine, Joe. Can I ask you, when you said to your family, I'm going to leave the priesthood, and they asked you why, what did you say?
Well, I remember I told my Uncle Tom. I was very fond of my Uncle Tom. At that time, this is 5 years in now, not when I finally left, 9 years in. Slow learner. The penny drops slow. But 5 years, and I went to my uncle. And of course, one of the problems was, because I had difficulties at home. You know, I didn't get on great with my mother. And so going home to her wasn't a great idea. But I hadn't a penny, not a penny in the world. And I hadn't finished my degree. So I was kind of trapped. But my Uncle Tom, he cried. I met him in Cleary's. A lot of your listeners will remember Cleary's. Mm. And there was a restaurant upstairs. And we met in the restaurant upstairs. And I told him. And he cried. And then he wiped his eyes and he said, I'll give you £1,000. That'll keep you going until you finish your degree in the summer. And then you're on your own. And like suddenly I actually didn't need, you know, I could actually go. And then, oh God, when I was writing this book, in my gut, I was looking through all my journals and I was seeing, how did I decide to stay? Because I did. I stayed another
3 years.
Years. And I looked back at my journals and thought, well, he said that and he said that and he said that and she said that. And it undermined my trust in my gut. I put aside my trust in my inner workings. And it was really bad for me. It was detrimental to me because suddenly I had reached a conscientious choice to leave and I had allowed other people to undermine that. And it just let. Now, that said, 9 years later, when I finally left, the big life lesson that I had learned was this, that I and I alone must choose. And it didn't matter if the Pope himself came in and begged me on bended knees, Joe, don't go. I was going to go because I was going to respect my inner workings.
And that inner workings you keep referring to, you speak about it more in the book, but was that telling you you've too much doubt, you don't want this kind of life, you don't believe in God? What was it telling you?
It was all of the above.
Right.
You know, like it was both doubting the vocation, but more fundamentally it was doubting God, you know. And yeah, profoundly doubting God. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any God. Like nobody today believes in the Celtic gods or the Norse gods or the Greek gods or the Roman gods. We do believe in other gods because there are other gods, which in fact are relatively new in terms of human history. They've only been around maybe 2,000 years. It's not that long, you know. And it's scary when you follow your inner workings and think, you know, I just don't believe in that anymore.
It must have been terrifying. And liberating at the same time.
Exactly. You have it in one, Jen. It was absolutely, it was terrifying and it was liberating.
Did you have a post-priest plan?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. And like, again, to be fair to the Mars, like they, because I had heard horror stories of other people who'd been like 9 years or longer.
Yeah.
And they were handed like 200 quid or something, you know. And the Mars, they gave me 500 quid and also the superior, lovely guy at the time. And it was summertime, so all the priests would have got holiday money anyway. So he insisted I take that with me. So I probably had about 800 quid when I left, which
for
was
new life.
Considerably more. Than it was probably enough to keep, you know, get me going for a month.
Yeah, totally. You know?
Yeah.
Talk to me about so you've left with your 800 quid, right? And you've big decisions to make. What are you going to do with your life? Because that's taken up a huge amount of your life. First of all, how did your family feel? Were they okay with this decision? Did it take them a while to accept it, or what happened there?
Well, again, you know, I had a difficult relationship with my mother, so I honestly didn't know, and I'd always been unsure what she thought. So, you know, and my sister had left her job the same year and gone off to France, and that actually had inspired me a bit, because there was I in the middle of all this inner wrestling, and it did. I thought, well, you know, my sister's gone and done that, and fair juice to her, and sounds like a good decision. And so that was sort of it, you know. So the family, it wasn't a big issue.
Good. That's good to hear. Can you talk to me about life since then? You got married. You had two kids.
I got married. Now, here's the thing. Well, I tell you, Jen, here's the thing. One of the reasons, like, I joined the seminary for good reasons, but I also joined them for reasons of lack of inner confidence. So I honestly never believed as a kid, like a lot of teenagers growing up, they have such a low self-concept, right? But I just never imagined that any woman would want to spend her life with me, boring old me, you know, with all my confusions and angst and you know, nerdiness and all the rest. I just never believed. And that was partly what motivated me to go in there. And so when I left, like I left, and I'm now...
Went to Coppers. Is that what you did?
I didn't go to Coppers. I met my missus. I met my missus a couple of years. I met my missus a couple of years after I'd left. And basically, I met her. I'm now 59, right? Uh-huh. And I met her when I was 29. And within a month, we was coming up to Easter. Actually, it was just before my 30th birthday. We met again. My second kind of date with her was on the just before my 30th birthday, or on my 30th birthday, and she gave me a chocolate biscuit. And I thought, that's it. Anyway, we had a go, and I proposed to her very quickly. I mean, because when you know, you know.
Ah, yeah.
And now...
Your gut. You're listening to your gut now, Joe. I mean,
listen to
you're on the right
that
path.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And once you're listening... I'm really glad you said that. I struggled for... Like, I was 25 years writing this book, right? And I went through probably 25 titles. And finally, you know, coming up with In My Gut, I Don't Believe. It was so important, because actually the whole thing... And my whole kind of happiness and authenticity all flowed from beginning to trust my gut.
I have to ask you, because now you're a humanist celebrant.
I am.
What does that mean, and how did you get to that point?
Well, I, you know, had spent 9 years studying for the priesthood, thought that I would be with people at important times in their lives, like baptism, birth of a child, marriage and death. And, you know... I wanted to be with people at the level of their meaning, you know, what was important to them. And so I joined the Humanist Association of Ireland, I don't know, probably 2010 or something like that. I didn't know that they did ceremonies. And then when I discovered that they did ceremonies, I thought to myself, sure, hang on a bit. You know, I could actually do what I was trained to do without the religious bit.
Without the religious bit. So just explain for people who don't know what being a humanist entails. It's all the events and the coming together. And you probably explain better than I. Go on. So what is it exactly?
Okay. Well, humanism basically, as it's generally understood these days, is, you know, a humanist would be somebody who doesn't believe in a God or an afterlife, but... who believes that you can be good without God, and that we don't, you know, I personally don't need to believe in a God to be good. And also, I don't think that people who do believe in God, if they stop believing God, I don't think they go out and rape people and murder people and steal from people, right? So I don't believe that we need to believe in God to be good. And so humanists basically are people of a like mind to myself, like Socrates, you know, he was a Greek philosopher.
Yeah.
And we could see him as the first humans, in a sense, because there were beliefs and religions in his day, and he got into trouble because he was questioning the beliefs, the religious beliefs of his day, and he was tried for blasphemy. Mm. And his whole thing was, look, let's just ask questions and let's just know ourselves. And he said the most important thing in life wasn't to believe in God or the gods or whatever, that the most important thing he thought in life was to know yourself. To know yourself. And that's why I wrote this book. Because I wrote it for me. Yeah. I wanted to find out, how the heck did I transition from, you know, aged 80 and believing the only thing I wanted to do on the planet was to be a priest? How did I transition from that to, I don't believe in God?
It's funny how you mentioned playing priest. I remember playing mass as a kid in the green with kids on the road. It's just a thing
Good
we did.
Good for you. Good for you.
Listen, I'm far from the priesthood or the nunnery at this stage.
But you are planning to be a woman priest. You see, and that's the other thing, you see. And that's, like, I have, like, the deceit of religion does annoy me. Like, I was one of them. So I'm not, but the notion that the church will come out and say that they have no authority to ordain women, I just find that so deceitful. You know, the church claims to have the authority to tell gay people that they shouldn't, you know, get married to one another or, you know, express their homosexuality. It's like they have the audacity to say that to real people, and yet they claim that they don't have the authority to ordain women. Do you know?
Joe, finally, I mean, first of all, I could talk to you all morning, okay? And I'm going to mention your book again, but I really want to ask you, what would you say to 18-year-old Joe now?
I'll tell you what I want to say to an 18-year-old now.
Go on.
Listen to yourself. Listen to yourself. I call it my inner workings. Like, and sometimes you don't know what you're thinking. So what I do is I journal. I take out a blank page and I write down, I did it this morning. I'm still at it. And I write down everything that's in my head, and it's just from my eyes. Nobody else gets to read that, right? So, you know, and that's the stuff without which, if I hadn't done that, I couldn't have written my book. So that's what I'm saying to 18-year-olds. Trust yourself. Trust your inner workings. Trust your doubts.
Yeah.
Trust your nudges. Trust, you know, if you feel, oh, but I'm safe where I am, well, just test yourself, you know, because all kind of people are in some people are in situations and they think, this is it. I can't be happy outside. This is as good as it gets. And it's not.
You're not
stuck.
You
know, if you trust yourself, you can eventually find the inner strength and the inner courage to be yourself and become authentic.
Joe Armstrong, thank you so much for being with us this morning. In My Gut, I believe, is out now. Go and check it out.
I don't believe, Jen. In My Gut, I don't believe.
I don't. In My Gut, I Don't Believe is the book. Beg your pardon. In My Gut, I Don't Believe. That's a very important part. That end bit is a very important part of the book. Jesus, it defined your whole life and the changes you made.
Jen, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Honestly, I really enjoyed this chat. I wish you and your lovely family the very best luck in everything you do. And I'll be ringing you to do a baby name and service on my child in a couple of weeks' time. See you, Joe.
I'd love to. Thank you, Jen.
Bye, love. Bye. That is Joe Armstrong. The book, In My Gut, I Don't Believe. It is out now. Go and check it out. What a guy. He was phenomenal. Love that. Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.